I want you to picture something with me for a second. Just kind of drop yourself right into this hyper-specific, like highly sensory visualization.
Okay, I'm ready.
So imagine a massive piece of cotton paper just sitting on a wooden table. But we aren't talking about your standard flimsy printer paper here.
Right.
This stuff is so incredibly thick and dense, it feels almost like a heavy piece of cardboard in your hands. Now imagine that pristine paper actively flooding with water. And into that water, someone is dropping heavy, intensely vibrant mineral pigments.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And looking down at this table, it just looks like total, absolute chaos, like a disaster about to happen.
I mean, it literally looks like a puddle of ruined materials at that stage, which is, the sheer terror and the thrill of this specific medium.
It's not true.
You are constantly operating on this razor's edge of like, is this going to be a masterpiece or just a muddy disaster?
Right. But from that watery chaos, from this intense physical battle of fluids, what emerges is one of the most profound symbols of urban peace you could ever look at. It's a painting of a cat resting perfectly still on a bicycle at sunset.
Which is just a brilliant visual paradox, if you think about it. You're taking a machine that's designed entirely for kinetic energy, and you're turning it into a pedestal for absolute stillness.
Welcome to today's deep dive. Our mission today is to pull back the curtain on the profound design logic behind artistic choices like that one. Because, we aren't just taking a casual stroll through a crowded museum looking at finished paintings on a wall and trying to guess what they mean.
No, definitely not. We have a very rare, incredibly transparent stack of sources today.
Yeah, it's amazing.
We're examining one specific watercolor piece called Bisigato by the artist Gerard Duque, which is part of his larger collection called Trasteo Pintura Artistica.
And the reason we can do this so thoroughly is because we don't just have like a high-resolution image of the final painting. We have the complete technical sheet detailing every single material used.
Which is so rare to get.
It really is. And most amazingly, we have the intimate personal notes from the artist himself. I mean, it feels like getting a magician's personal diary. We actually get to see the physics, the mechanics, and all the failures before we ever see the magic.
That completely changes the stakes of our conversation today. I mean, we aren't doing an inventory of the image, just pointing out, oh, a wheel here and a cloud there.
Right.
We are doing a forensic investigation into a creator's mind inside his laboratory in Whittier, California, in April of 2025.
And just to clarify for you listening, Whittier, California isn't what the painting is a picture of. That is the physical location of the artist's studio.
Exactly, yeah.
That's the laboratory where this intense negotiation of materials is happening. Our goal is to unpack how these incredibly precise technical choices aren't just about, making something aesthetically pleasing. They're designed to create powerful emotions and literally act as an antidote to your daily urban stress.
And to understand that emotional antidote, we really have to start exactly where Gerard Duque starts, which is with the physics of the blank page.
The actual paper itself.
Right. Because before any concept can exist in the viewer's mind, the material reality of the art has to be negotiated. The medium itself dictates the rules of engagement.
So diving into that, the technical sheet gives us the exact physical architecture of this setup. Duke is using Arches paper, specifically 640 gram paper. Like I mentioned, that is incredibly dense.
Yeah, that's heavy duty.
For context, a standard piece of paper you might have on your desk is maybe 80 grams. This is pure cotton, and the notes specify it is cold pressed and coarse grain.
And that term, coarse grain, is a really crucial technical detail. When paper is cold pressed, it means the manufacturing cylinders didn't like iron it out into a perfectly smooth surface.
Okay, so it has texture.
Exactly. On a microscopic level, this paper is a rugged terrain. It is full of tiny physical peaks and valleys.
And he needs that specific rugged terrain because of the sheer volume of water he's about to throw at it, right? I mean, if you try this on normal paper, it would just buckle and warp and disintegrate.
Oh, completely. It would just turn to mush.
But it's not just the durability of the paper that matters here, it's the chemistry of the paint itself. He's using Daniel Smith brand watercolors, which, according to our sources, use real crushed mineral pigments.
Yes.
We're talking about actual semi-precious stones ground down into a powder and mixed with a binder.
And that introduces some really complex fluid dynamics into the process.
How so?
Well, many cheap watercolors use synthetic dyes, which basically just stain the paper evenly. But because these are real physical minerals, they have actual mass and weight.
Oh, I see where you're going with this.
Yeah, so when the artist applies this massive amount of water, creating what is essentially a hyper-controlled flood, gravity takes over. Those heavy mineral pigments are literally pulled down by gravity into the microscopic valleys of that coarse cotton paper we just talked about.
So he isn't sitting there with a tiny single hair brush painting every little bump and texture to make the sky look realistic.
No, not at all.
He's letting gravity and physics do the heavy lifting. You know, it makes me think of a chef who works with wild fermentation, or like an architect who builds a structure using living, unseasoned wood.
That's a great comparison.
You can't just force the medium to do whatever you want with brute strength. You have to negotiate with it.
Yeah.
You set up the perfect conditions, but then you kind of just have to step back and let the physics happen.
Right. And this lack of total control is a deliberate design choice. The artist is leveraging the forces of the natural world, gravity, fluid dynamics, the actual physical weight of the minerals to build a chaotic organic environment. The texture basically builds itself.
But if he's actively constructed this incredibly rugged, chaotic physical environment using heavy minerals and pooling water,
yeah,
whatever he actually paints on top of it needs a serious amount of conceptual weight to hold its own.
Absolutely.
He needs a tension that matches the physical battle happening on the paper.
Which brings us to the core conceptual motor of Bisegato, which is the tension between advancing and remaining.
Let's break that down. We've got this bicycle and we have this cat. Two things you see every single day,
yeah,
but putting them together creates this massive friction.
Think about what a bicycle represents to the human brain. It is the ultimate promise of human transit. It's mechanical energy, gears, chains, rubber tires.
Yeah.
Even when it's standing perfectly still, a bicycle represents the speed of city life. You know, the motors, the sirens, the vibrating asphalt we navigate every day to get to work. It is a machine built for fleeing.
Then right on top of this mechanical promise of velocity, you have a cat resting its body over the frame. And the cat introduces absolute serene quietness.
Yes.
It's a complete appropriation of space. The animal does not care that this machine is meant for human transportation.
And this triggers a very specific psychological response. When you look at a bicycle, your brain has a predictive model that automatically anticipates action.
Like it expects the wheels to spin.
Exactly. By placing a resting, perfectly relaxed cat on top of it, the design forces your brain's predictive model to hit a wall. It creates cognitive dissonance. The machine says go, the animal says stay.
I do wonder about the mechanics of painting that, though. Because, wait, if the bike represents the chaotic speed of the city, how do you paint Swede without relying on those cheesy kinetic motion lines?
What do you mean?
You know, like in a comic book where there are little lines trailing behind the tires, or blurring the edges of the bike to make it look like a photograph taken out of a moving car.
Oh, right. Well, doing that would actually ruin the tension. Attempting to paint literal motion in a static, two-dimensional medium often falls flat and just looks cartoonish.
Yeah, it can look pretty cheap.
The artist isn't painting movement itself. He is painting the anticipation of movement. The tension exists entirely in your mind because you know what a bicycle is capable of, but you are currently watching its potential being held hostage by the sheer stillness of a sleeping cat.
Wow.
It's a masterclass in psychological design over literal depiction.
So the cat is basically acting as a physical anchor for all of that kinetic anxiety.
Exactly.
But to pull off this intense conceptual tension without just looking like a random collage of objects, the painting needs bones. It needs an underlying architectural structure.
Yeah, the bicycle isn't just a prop in the story. It serves as the painting's almost graphic skeleton. Think about the rigid geometry required to draw a bike. You have the perfect circles of the wheels and the strong intersecting diagonal metallic tubes of the frame.
Right.
These elements are meticulously placed to hold the visual weight of the entire piece.
In his personal notes, Duke mentions this explicitly. If you take the bike out of the painting, the cat is just floating aimlessly in space. It has no emotional anchor and no scale.
Yeah, it would just look lost.
But if you take the cat away, the bike is just a boring technical drawing of a machine. Those rigid metallic diagonals of the bike frame are completely necessary because they act as visual arrows. They force the viewer's eye directly up toward the soft, organic, living curves of the cat sitting on top.
And that structural geometry is then surrounded by a masterful handling of physical space and depth. If we look at the environment he built around the skeleton, the composition places the horizon line incredibly low.
Which means the vast majority of the paper is dedicated to this massive, luminous sky.
Yes. And the physical watercolor layering techniques he uses to build that environment are fascinating. To create that massive sky, the notes say he used broad, transparent washes.
So that's where the fluid dynamics come back in.
Exactly. He lets the water and the pigment dialogue freely using those fluid dynamics we talked about earlier. The result is this luminous, warm orange at the very bottom near the horizon that gradually fades up into this soft, ethereal violet at the top of the page.
That soft transparency is the perfect counterpart to how he handles the ground, though.
Mm.
The asphalt the bike is resting on isn't soft or ethereal at all.
No, not at all.
It's built using dense, dark, heavy values. And this isn't just a stylistic preference. It's a fundamental rule of how our eyes perceive depth and space.
Right. Atmospheric perspective.
Let's unpack the mechanics of that depth.
Yeah.
Like, why does making the asphalt dense and dark make this space feel real?
Well, it comes down to contrast and value. In visual psychology, areas of high contrast and dense dark values naturally advance toward our eye. They feel immediate and physically present.
Okay.
Conversely, areas that are transparent, light, and lacking sharp detail, like that glowing orange and violet sky, naturally recede into the distance.
That makes a lot of sense.
By using this technique, the artist anchors this incredibly ethereal floating sky firmly to our gravitational reality. The dark asphalt literally grounds the image.
It's almost like painting that sky is like carving a channel for a river. You know, you dig the path and set the boundaries, but you let the water and the minerals decide exactly how they want to flow and settle.
Oh, I like that.
But painting the asphalt, that's like laying bricks. You have to place every single piece with heavy, rigid, dark intention to make sure the foundation doesn't crumble.
That is a much more accurate way to visualize the difference in those techniques. And now that we have the fluid sky, the rigid ground, and the structural skeleton of the bike all established, we arrive at what I think is the most radical and risky design choice in the entire piece.
Which is what the artist strategically chose not to paint.
Exactly. The psychological impact of negative space.
In the painting, the cat and the bicycle are painted as an extreme backlight. They are just a massive, dark, unified tonal mass set against that vibrant sunset.
Yes, there's virtually no interior detail.
Right. There are no subtle highlights bouncing off the metal. You can't see the individual hairs of the cat's fur, you can't read the brand name on the bicycle frame, and you can't see the grease on the gears.
And the artist actually critiques himself on this very point in his personal notes, which is such a rare window into the creative process.
Yeah, we normally never get to see that.
He admits that he sacrificed the subtle transitions between the cold metal of the bike and the soft fur of the cat purely for the sake of visual impact. He notes that finding a better balance between that dark unity and subtle separation is a challenge he wants to tackle in future works.
That's amazing.
It really highlights that studio as a laboratory mindset. The painting isn't just a product, it's an experiment for the next one.
I look at that massive dark silhouette, though, and part of me thinks, isn't that just kind of taking the easy way out?
How so?
Like hiding the bike and the cat in the shadow so he doesn't have to sit there for 40 hours painting 100 tiny realistic gears and photorealistic fur.
It is a common critique of abstracted art, but withholding that detail is actually the ultimate sign of mature design logic. Think about what happens if you paint every single hair on that cat and you paint the exact logo and scratch marks on that bike. What you have created is an anecdote.
An anecdote.
Yeah. You have tainted one very specific cat on one very specific Tuesday in one specific city.
Oh, I see. It stops being a universal symbol and just becomes a documentary photograph.
By hiding the specific details within that dark silhouette, he avoids the anecdote entirely. And this is where the psychology of negative space gets really brilliant. The human brain abhors a vacuum.
Right.
When you present the brain with a blank, featureless space that is in the recognizable shape of an object, like a cat on a bike, the brain automatically reaches into its own archives to fill it in.
So by not painting the details of the cat, he is essentially forcing the viewer to project their own memories of a cat onto the canvas. Because we don't remember every single hair on an animal we love. We remember the shape, the posture, the feeling of them. So this design turns you from a passive observer who is just evaluating his brushstrokes into an active participant in the design. The negative space is literally acting as a mirror for your own memory.
And that psychological engagement is an incredibly powerful tool when you consider the real-world application of this artwork. This manipulation of physics, geometry, and negative space isn't just the artist showing off his technical skills for other artists.
No, it has a function.
Right. It has a profound purpose for the busy, stressed commuter who stops to look at it.
This brings us to how this art applies directly to daily urban stress. In his notes, Duke talks about the cat as the undisputed king of urban interstices.
The urban interstices. These are the tiny, overlooked corners of the city.
Think about that narrow, weird gap between a subway grate and a brick wall that you walk past 100 times a week but never actually look at.
Yeah, or the ledge just behind a row of dumpsters in an alleyway.
We, as rushed, stressed humans, completely ignore these spaces because we are too busy looking at our phones, checking our watches, or thinking about our next meeting.
But the cat is the master of those spaces. The cat finds the quiet pockets that humans abandon. And in this painting, the cat goes a step further. It peacefully invades our anxiety-inducing mode of transport.
Right.
It takes a machine that we use to rush through the city, and it turns it into a throne for sunset observation.
That is exactly why a painting like this functions as a manual brake for the viewer's neural pathways. When you are rushing through your day, your brain is operating on a closed loop of anxiety and schedules.
100%.
Seeing this design interrupts that loop. It isn't just a pretty picture for your living room. It trains the viewer to start looking for the silent observers in their own concrete landscapes. It is a cure for the blindness caused by our daily stress.
And there is one detail in the artist's notes regarding this scene that adds an entirely new layer of beautiful tension to it. It's the concept of the unseen minute later.
Oh, I love this part.
The painting captures this perfect, serene, quiet moment. But the artist knows, and the viewer intuitively knows, that this moment is entirely ephemeral.
Because eventually, the stressed human owner of that bicycle is going to come out of the coffee shop or the office building and return to claim their machine.
And when they do, there is going to be this inevitable clash of worlds. The human who is rushing, stressed, and desperate to get home is going to confront this animal that has claimed their kinetic machine as a place of absolute rest.
Yeah.
It creates this invisible live tension on the sidewalk that exists just outside the frame of the painting.
It raises an important question about how we share our environment. Like, when that moment happens, do you chase the cat away in a panic because you were late? Or do you stop, take a breath, and appreciate the pause that the universe just handed you?
It forces you to evaluate your own relationship with time and speed.
It's funny, I really don't think I'll be able to walk past a bike locked to a street sign on my walk home today without looking at the negative space around it.
Oh, definitely.
I'm going to look for the stillness. I'm going to look at the shadows. The design logic of this piece genuinely shifts how you view the mundane urban landscape.
Which is the highest compliment you can give to a piece of art. It didn't just entertain you for a few minutes, it fundamentally altered your perception of your own reality.
Let's summarize the journey we've taken today. We started with a heavy piece of coarse cotton paper sitting in a laboratory in Whittier, California. We explored a hyper-controlled flood of heavy mineral pigments and fluid dynamics, watching gravity build a rugged terrain.
Yes.
We navigated the structural geometry of a bicycle frame and the mechanics of contrast and depth, all to arrive at a psychological masterpiece, a piece that uses extreme silhouettes and negative space to actively combat our modern urban anxiety.
It's just brilliant.
It really is.
And for anyone listening who wants to see the piece we've been dissecting today, you can find Bicigato and the rest of the collection at artecolorado.com.
It really is a testament to the fact that true design isn't just about what you proudly put on the canvas, but what you intentionally have the discipline to leave out.
That idea actually brings me to a final thought I want to leave you with today, something we haven't touched on yet, but that has been bouncing around in my head ever since we started talking about negative space and memory.
Okay, well, what is it?
Well, if the sheer power of this artwork, its ability to move us and cure our stress, comes from its lack of detail, well, let me rephrase that. If it comes from the negative space, forcing our brains to actively project our own memories to fill in the blanks, what does that mean for us right now?
In what sense?
We live in an era of hyper-detailed AI-generated imagery and endless passive scrolling. Every pixel of our screens is filled with maximum information, maximum color, and maximum detail all the time.
That's true. There's no visual rest.
Right. There are no blank spaces left.
Yeah.
So are we losing our psychological ability to fill in the blanks? Are we losing the capacity to find our own urban poetry simply because Modern media leaves absolutely zero negative space for our minds to work with.
That is a deeply unsettling but very necessary question to ponder. Because if everything is explicitly drawn out and spoon-fed to us, the muscle of our imagination, our ability to project ourselves into the art, starts to atrophy.
Exactly. Something to mull over the next time you find yourself staring at a screen filled with endless detail, instead of looking at the empty spaces between the buildings around you. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep your eyes open to the quiet interstices of your own city today. You never know what kind of stillness is waiting for you there.